In the coming week, President Biden travels to Poland as Russia's war in Ukraine enters a new phase. Leaders from OPEC and non-OPEC countries convene virtually, and international themes abound at the Academy Awards. It's March 24th, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Charlie Kupchin, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Charlie is senior fellow at CFR and professor of international affairs at Georgetown University in the Walsh School of Foreign Service and Department of Government. Charlie, as always, great to have you on the show.
Glad to be back, Bob, and look forward to the conversation.
We should know Charlie was a recent guest on our sister podcast that Jim hosts, The President's Inbox, where a few weeks ago he was taking stock of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. A lot has happened since then, Charlie, but why don't we kick off with what's happening in Europe at the moment. President Biden, as we're taping this podcast, was wrapping up NATO and EU summit, and I think somewhere in there was a G7 summit as well. Tomorrow, he's due to hold a bilateral meeting with the Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, and it seems like there will be a great deal of discussion and focus on what Poland's been doing in terms of absorbing the humanitarian burden of huge refugee flows, by far the highest number going into Poland from Ukraine. That figure overall is something like 3.6 million now. So can you update us on the situation more generally, Charlie, and tell us what we need to know about this trip to Poland?
Sure. Unfortunately, Bob, not a whole lot has changed since I joined Jim Lindsay for a discussion about the war in Ukraine. The fighting continues, even though the Russians have not advanced as quickly as many expected. There seems to be a stalemate of sorts for now, but the Russians are seemingly doubling down. They're increasing their attacks against the cities and civilian population centers. That's not out of character. That tends to be what the Russians do. But I think it's safe to say that there is more fluidity to the conflict now than many expected, including in Russia itself, where because the war has not gone according to plan, Putin is facing pushback from the Russian public and even from his own elites. So I would say stay tuned. This is a very fluid situation. President Biden went to Europe this week to hold a set of emergency summits with NATO, a US-EU gathering, and a G7 meeting. And in many respects, the headline here is the symbolism. This is a trip that is about demonstrating US-European democratic solidarity in the face of what is the most significant war in Europe since World War II. A major European power has invaded its neighbor. And so far, the United States, its European allies, its G7 partners have responded with amazing rapidity and with amazing solidarity. And I think Biden's main goal in going to Europe this week is to demonstrate to Mr. Putin and to the Russians that the U.S. and its allies stand shoulder to shoulder. The main takeaways, I think, from this trip are, number one, that NATO is going to deploy an additional set of combat troops to the eastern flank of NATO. That's a process that began in 2016 called Enhanced Forward Presence. Those deployments went to the three Baltic states and Poland. Now we're seeing more to states that are bordering Ukraine. Secondly, we're seeing new sanctions that are going to be put principally on members of the Duma. This is yet another effort to punish Russians for what is happening in Ukraine. And then on the humanitarian front, I think that Biden will give a shout out to the Poles and the EU more broadly for a very magnanimous and generous welcoming of millions of refugees from Ukraine. And it's important to keep in mind that migration has been in some ways the most volatile issue confronting the European Union. Not more than a couple of months ago, the Poles had deployed police and troops to their border with Belarus to prevent migrants from coming in, and now they're opening their borders.
And it's been suggested that one of the many byproducts that I think Putin envisioned from the invasion was the so-called weaponization of refugees and adding that to the mix in terms of stirring up instability and grievances, especially in NATO's eastern flank.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say whether Putin deliberately has attempted to crack the EU by flooding it with refugees, but it's certainly possible. And we're hearing today that the Biden administration is announcing a decision to open the U.S. to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees, which is a way of saying to Europe, we're standing with you. You are shouldering new burdens. We will do so as well.
Charlie, do you see any concern about this kind of delicate balancing act? Much has been discussed about the appeals for no-fly zone, especially as you see some of these cities, especially Mariupol, basically reduced to almost dust, but also a more vigorous response from NATO that borders on taking the fight to Russia in a way that would escalate things further. I mean, do you see, is this something that the alliance partners are kind of wrangling with, or that there's a pretty straightforward path here? This is a bit new territory in terms of vis-a-vis Russia.
I think that President Biden said early on, while the Russian invasion of Ukraine was looming, that we're not going to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. We're not sending combat troops. And now that the war has begun, NATO is trying to find the right sweet spot, would be one way to put it, between arming the Ukrainians, helping Ukrainians defend themselves, and giving them the kinds of weapons that could potentially escalate the conflict into a NATO-Russia war, which probably would turn into World War III. And so NATO is giving anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, lots of munitions, but has decided not to enforce a no-fly zone, not to allow fighter aircraft to be transferred from Poland via the United States bases in Germany into Ukraine. This is a subjective judgment.
Yeah.
Why you can do X, Y, Z, but not A, B, C is difficult to say. One way of thinking about it is the weapons that we're transferring are largely defensive, and we're not going to give them offensive weapons. I'm not particularly happy with that distinction because most lethal weapons can be used either offensively or defensively. So this really is a judgment call. I think that NATO will continue to stand by its desire to prevent a potential full-scale NATO-Russia war, but it could happen in any case because of spillover. You know, there are a lot of weapons flowing into Ukraine from Poland, from other NATO countries, and it's not inconceivable that the Russians could take a strike against those weapons before they get into Ukraine. And then we're talking about the possibility of a wider war.
And we saw the warnings just ahead of the trip of, you know, a potential false flag Russian operation involving chemical weapons, and that could have cross-border spillovers or a massive cyber attack on, let's say, Western targets. And that's new territory as well. So again, this just seems like there's a new terrain here that's getting very tricky. And then on top of that, reports that the talks that are supposed to be held at a certain level between the two militaries, the Russian and the U.S. militaries, have not been taking place because the Russians are just not engaging. All that raises kind of the ominous signals. But we should look at the Poland trip as, at this point, shoring up an ally that seems to be on the front lines.
Yeah, I mean, Poland is a country that's complicated because it has a government that the EU itself has called illiberal, and it's taken steps that have compromised the independence of the media, compromised the independence of its court system. But right now, everybody's really focused on the war in Ukraine, and Poland has risen to the occasion and is not just welcoming refugees, but taking a strong line to push back against the Russians. In fact, we heard yesterday that the Poles are going to expel dozens of Russian diplomats that they have designated as individuals carrying out espionage. So right now, I would say that we see a revival of Western solidarity, the countries of NATO standing shoulder to shoulder. It's impressive. I would say, in some respects, the degree of unity, the extensive nature of the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia probably go beyond what many people expected just 4 weeks ago.
Charlie, one area of potential cracks in that unity could be the position involving Russian energy imports, which many countries in the EU rely on heavily, if not totally. We'll have to see how that bears out and what sort of replacements come into the picture. But the whole issue of the Russian invasion and its impact on global oil prices is certainly a backdrop to the upcoming OPEC and non-OPEC ministerial meeting in the week ahead. Can you give us a little bit more insight, Charlie, into what we need to know about that meeting, the OPEC and non-OPEC ministerial meeting?
Sure. And you're right, Bob, to identify the whole question of European reliance on Russian fossil fuels as a tough nut. And it is. And that's because many European countries, including Germany, rely heavily on imports of Russian gas in particular to keep their lights on, to heat apartments, to keep factories running. The EU has said that it's going to decrease substantially its dependence on Russian oil and gas, but that's not easy. That brings us to the whole question of the OPEC meeting that you mentioned. And from what we can gather in advance, OPEC is unlikely to engage in any substantial increase in production. And I think there are probably two different issues at play. One is that OPEC members, oil producers, don't mind the fact that oil prices are rising. Why? Because that means that every barrel that they pull out of the ground, they make more money on. And secondly, Russia looms large as an oil producer. It's part of OPEC Plus. And we've seen over the last few weeks that important members of OPEC are not ready to break with Russia. They have not pushed back in the United Nations. They have not spoken out to condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think what's going on here is a combination of high prices work for us, so why mess with them? And we don't really want to pick a fight with Russia right now, in part because some of them have very good relations with Russia. A lot of Russians go to Gulf countries. They invest in Gulf countries. They buy apartments in Gulf countries. And so it's a complicated picture here, but there's no question that part of the discussion that is taking place in Europe today is about how the U.S. and Europe collectively can help the EU diminish its reliance on Russian fossil fuel. And part of that is about getting other sources. Liquid natural gas from the U.S., from others, is an important part of that conversation.
I guess it's also worth pointing out that a number of OPEC countries, many of them are autocracies themselves, like Russia, and don't necessarily like to see autocracies isolated and cut off in such a fashion. A couple of them that have had their share of sanctions and isolation, including Venezuela and Iran, have recently been in the news because they could be opening up their markets. It's not clear yet, but there's one line of analysis that's saying, you know, because the U.S. has not done enough to make itself completely independent, oil independent, it's had to try to re-enlist Iran into the nuclear deal, and it's going to allow Iran, this repressive regime, to gain oil revenues. And it also sent a mission to Venezuela because it wants the Venezuelan oil to ease the prices at the U.S. pump. What do you make of that analysis, Charlie, and the concern about what kind of navigation the Biden administration has to do at this moment?
I've never been entirely comfortable with the framing of our geopolitical moment as a clash between democracy and autocracy. It's more complicated than that. That having been said, Russia's invasion of Ukraine to some extent brings that duality into focus because China appears to be ready to stand by Russia. It's conceivable to me, Bob, that we're looking at some kind of Cold War 2.0, which could be not just with the Russians, but with some Russia-China bloc, a bloc of autocracies versus a bloc of democracies. I can't say that we're there yet, but we obviously can't dismiss that possibility. That having been said, there are inconsistencies in that approach, some of which you just mentioned, and that is the United States will need to work with non-democracies to deal with a world that is more geopolitically unstable. And this is the case that existed during the Cold War. The United States cozied up with a lot of unsavory regimes because it decided that it needed to do so for geopolitical reasons. And I think what we're seeing now is an effort to reach out to the United Arab Emirates, the Saudis, the Venezuelans, the Iranians, because the price of oil is a big deal. And so, yeah, it does look like we're in a kind of democracy versus autocracy world, but the lines are much more fuzzy than I think many people would like to admit.
No, I think that's a good point, Charlie. And also the Cold War analogies kind of run aground when you consider that the way the Soviet Union was really cut off from the world in lots of, you know, economic ways, in ways that China and as we're seeing with Russia have not been. They've been very integrated, and the world generally has needed their involvement, whether it's manufacturing power from China or the resources of Russia, but also resources from China. Lithium production from China is vital. And obviously lithium needed for batteries that power electric vehicles, which is the conversion and then from a world of fossil fuels into non-fossil fuels. So yeah, as you say, Charlie, it's a lot at stake and we'll see whether there's any kind of change in the OPEC messaging.
Let me just pick up on that comment, Bob, because I think it's in some ways the $6 million question. And that is this a pivotal moment, an inflection point in which we not just see the emergence of a militarized and divided Europe, but we see deglobalization? Because I think what we're witnessing vis-a-vis Russia is the weaponization of globalization. The fact that Russia parked many of its central bank assets abroad, the fact that Russian banks use the SWIFT international payment system, the fact that Russian industries are heavily reliant on imports of technology. This is what exposes them to the sanctions that the United States and its allies have been imposing. And so we're looking at this. The Chinese are looking at this. The Germans are looking at this. And they're saying, yeah, an interdependent globalized world is great, but now it starts looking like it poses huge vulnerabilities. And so one thing to keep an eye on in the days, weeks, months ahead, do we see Western major economies begin to distance themselves from the Chinese and the Chinese begin to distance themselves from us because they have become convinced that maybe there's too much globalization and that leaves them geopolitically and economically exposed?
A giant exercise in cord cutting.
We'll see. I guess I'm not expecting it, in part because I think the costs are huge if we do see that kind of global decoupling. But it is now something that is on the table. It is in the windscreen.
So not just your typical OPEC ministerial by any account, Charlie?
No. This takes place against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine, which puts everybody's mind in focus on energy prices. Why don't we pivot, Bob, and turn our attention to a somewhat more uplifting, more enjoyable topic, and that is the Academy Awards that are upcoming. A lot of great foreign films are up for a shout out. Tell us more about which international films are getting the attention and give us a preview of the Sunday show.
Happy to do so, Charlie. As listeners to the podcast will know, I typically kind of beat a drum about foreign movies, or shall I say international films, at this time of year. And what's been happening over the course of those annual reviews is that I don't really need to do that anymore. The Academy has embraced and increasingly embraces international films. You're seeing a growing number of sort of crossover candidates that it's not just, hey, here's a list of five international films you should check out at some point, but now we're going to go back to the main event. They're becoming part of the main event. We've had in recent years, Charlie, as people might recall, some big movies that have emerged from international directors and from other film ecosystems. So you've had Roma from Mexico and Alfonso Cuarón. You've had Parasite from South Korea and Bong Joon-ho. Parasite ended up winning 4 Oscars in Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best International Feature Film, and Best Picture. It was a huge moment a few years ago. And so now you have this year, you have a 3-hour-long Japanese film in subtitle that is not only nominated for International Feature Film, but for Best Picture. And it's based on a Haruki Murakami story involving an actor who seeks a chauffeur and ends up developing an interesting relationship with a 20-year-old girl who becomes his chauffeur. And the relationship becomes kind of the pivot for all sorts of insights into sort of modern society. As usual, the other candidates are also provide insights into sometimes very, very small focused, nationally or locally focused issues, but with larger messages. In the case of Flea, it's a bigger story. This is actually an animated movie made in Denmark, and it's based on the tale of a gay Afghan refugee and sort of his plight in fleeing to Europe. This was made before the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban, and so it takes on additional poignancy now. And by the way, a whole host of refugee and humanitarian issues are continuing to plague Afghanistan, that getting a little bit overshadowed by Ukraine at the moment. There's a movie that's out of Norway called The Worst Person in the World. It centers around a young woman who's kind of navigating her troubled love life, but it has all sorts of other nuances and messages as well. There's the first ever nominated movie out of Bhutan, which is a bit of a coming of age story, I guess you could say, about someone going from the city to the countryside and their observations on life. And then a story based in Naples in the 1980s, which called The Hand of God, relating to the to Diego Maradona and his famous goal in the World Cup, but also what Maradona meant to a local Italian teen during that time period. So you have the kind of stories that were more typically parts of the Film Academy's review in American films, or at least from indie filmmakers. And certainly there are indie films that are continuing to explore these. But when you go to an American movie theater these days, which is something that people are starting to do once again in numbers for the first time, it seems to be overwhelmingly this big budget kind of almost comic book dominated venue. I went a couple of times with my daughters to see some movies, and 9 out of 10 of the previews, and there were at least 10 previews, and a couple of those were these massive, high-tech, very explosive, very noisy movies that were involving comic book type figures or figures coming to life who were not real or whatever, and less about other movies that are sort of looking at the human condition, shall we say, and that kind of thing. But I will say it's worth walking through the other candidates, Charlie, just to give a sense of kind of the international flavor. One of the nominees for Best Picture is the sort of semi-autobiographical film from Kenneth Branagh called Belfast, which, through the experiences of a family, kind of helps portray what was going on in Northern Ireland between Protestants and Catholics. You have, in the documentary category, you have the movie Ascension about China and what the Chinese dream means in modern society today. You've got Riding with Fire, which is a movie, this is also in the documentary category, a movie about India's only newspaper run by Dalit women. You've got in the short subject documentary, a story called Three Songs for Benazir, about a Afghan refugee, you know, with aspirations for a better life. And, you know, again, a lot of poignancy involving Afghan life stories right now. And then you have the sort of the bigger picture themes that that resonate. Interestingly, the movie Don't Look Up, which is this really broad satire about American society in particular. And it's a sort of a warning about climate change and the climate crisis. That was nominated for Best Picture. And that was, I guess, sort of a statement by the Academy about the issue. It's sort of taking these astronomers who have warning about an impending comet heading towards Earth, and they're not taken seriously, and nobody's really paying much attention to it, and there's navel gazing going on, and society is sort of doubling down on its own kind of psychoses. But it's worth a look. It's worth kind of a reflection on what it means for the way climate is being discussed or not discussed. And so, again, you have an Academy Awards, I think, Charlie, that is one going to be a kind of a celebration of going back to movies again, but also a broader look at what's going on in the world. And I think a final note I would add is that the whole streaming revolution, I think, has really internationalized the consumption of entertainment, especially movies. And people are less bothered by, seemingly because of what we've seen in streaming, people are less bothered by having to read subtitles and to get at a story. So I'll just leave you with that. But I do think it's going to be a really interesting Academy Award.
Let me ask you a quick question, because what you just described sounds to me like the democratization of the Academy Awards. It's getting more diverse. One explanation is streaming.
Yes, absolutely.
There are a couple other that come to mind that I'd like you to comment on. Are we seeing more high quality films produced abroad? And that's one of the reasons that they're getting shout outs. And is this also perhaps just part of the criticism that the Academy has faced for being too ethnocentric, too focused on Hollywood, need to focus on films that are being made elsewhere? How do you understand this transition in the films that are in play?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of those, Charlie. I think it absolutely the Academy has been facing pressure for the so-called expression Oscars so white. There was this real press for diversity, and I think they've responded to it in a lot of ways. They still have some ways to go. And that it's ethnic, it's racial, and it's also international. And I think they're also seeing the way audiences are responding. I think they're noticing when, you know, you look at the phenomenon of Squid Game. Now, this wasn't a movie. This was a series. This was kind of a phenomenon on, I believe it was on Netflix, from South Korea, about this real kind of nasty dystopia, but it kind of caught people's attention, and it was striking in what it was portraying. And I think, like a lot of people, our household, our teenage daughters got wind of it, and it was like must-see TV for a couple of weeks there. But, you know, also, I do think, you know, there's interest in internationalizing. And I guess what I would say is one of the things that's been a strength of Hollywood and the Academy Awards has been the attraction of talent from around the world, and either international casts and filmmakers coming to Hollywood to make movies, you know, in the U.S. that they're still coming out as sort of the formerly anointed Hollywood films, or being inspired by it. I remember I was living in the late 1990s in the Czech Republic when Kolya, won as Best International Movie. And, you know, a U.S. Academy taking time to award this was a gigantic event. It was similar to when the Czechs won the hockey gold medal in the Olympics. In some ways, hockey gold medal was bigger. Let me note that. But it was the lead news on that next morning after the Czechs had found that Kolya, and made by a well-known filmmaker and his father, and which was, by the way, a great story about the period of transition in the late 80s in then Czechoslovakia and relations with Russia and so forth. But it's, I guess what I'm saying, Charlie, is that Hollywood still stands for something like the major sports leagues. These are places where people come from around the world to get better and are also internationally known. But they are also opening up more and, I think, inspiring more. And so I think it's a good move. I think it's, as I said at the beginning, I think it's a way of countering this sort of hyper focus on blockbusters, on Marvel Comics blockbusters, in terms of spreading out the storytelling.
Bob, I think we're running out of time here. So let's pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on. This week, the audience selected Rohingya refugee genocide. What do you think about that?
The audience is taking note of the U.S. State Department designation of genocide. It was actually an event that Secretary of State Antony Blinken was attending at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, where he was saying, you know, what has occurred and really what occurred in 2017, so 5 years ago, in Myanmar against the Rohingya minority constitutes genocide. And you had, whether it was the deaths, it was as many as 1,600 deaths, but even beyond that, it was the types of deaths. It was the killing of children and women, and just the brutality and the singling out of these Rohingya, which is a Muslim minority in Myanmar, and then just driving them, you know, burning their homes, driving them out. Ultimately, about a million of them ended up fleeing, and many of them are still in Bangladesh. It's not looking like they're going to be returning anytime soon and going anywhere for that matter. This is the plight of the refugees in all their different aspects. And so I think what's interesting to note is, one, the fact of the genocide declaration. It's occurring roughly one year into the coup, the military coup in Myanmar. So there was a little bit of hesitance to be using this term while you still had a partially civilian-run country and people like Aung San Suu Kyi kind of leading the way. However, she was someone who actually had to go defend Myanmar in the international tribunal that was investigating this as well. And so there's a great deal of questioning about why a delay when it was clear what had happened against Rohingya was genocide. But still in all, the next step is, okay, what does this mean then? What does this mean in terms of any further sanctioning against the military junta? Which is itself fighting, it looks to be, multiple civil wars in Myanmar, Charlie. And then what it means in terms of consistency and other cases where the U.S. might be pressured to make similar declarations. It was noted that the Trump administration on its way out said genocide was being committed in Xinjiang in China, and the Biden administration has taken that up and also pointed to that and diplomatically boycotted the Olympics and so forth. So it's a question of, are we entering a new period where genocide is going to be recognized? And then will there be meaningful action against it?
Thank you for that explanation. And, you know, I guess my only comment would be, as we transition into a world that maybe one could call more realist, more balance of power, more us versus them, will you see the United States become less focused on human rights, less focused on democracy promotion than it has been, simply because of the geopolitical urgency demanded by a new era of rivalry with Russia and perhaps China? We'll see. Bob, that's our look at the world next week. A few other stories to keep an eye on. Defense Services Asia 2022 takes place in Kuala Lumpur. The Fridays for Future movement holds a global climate strike, and a general election is coming up in Malta.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Nicholas Martinez and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Charlie Kupchan. Bob, it's been a pleasure joining you, and farewell.
Charlie, thanks so much for joining us, and so long, everyone, and stay healthy out there.